Have you ever met someone so good at what they do that even the best in the world just stop and stare? I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because tonight I want to tell you about a man that Jimmy Doolittle once called the greatest stick-and-rudder pilot who ever lived. And when Jimmy Doolittle says that about you, well, that's the end of the conversation, isn't it? His name was Robert A. Hoover. Most folks just called him Bob. And if you ever saw him fly, you never forgot it. Not ever. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, Bob Hoover was born in 1922 in Nashville, Tennessee. And like a lot of us, he caught the bug early. The story goes that as a teenager, he used to hang around the local airport so much that a Piper Cub instructor finally let him take the controls just to get the kid to stop pestering him. Bob soloed before he could legally drive a car. Think about that. Couldn't drive to the airport, but he could fly the airplane once he got there. When the war came, Bob enlisted. He wanted fighters, and he got his wish. He was assigned to fly Spitfires with the 52nd Fighter Group in North Africa and the Mediterranean. Now, a young American kid from Nashville flying British Spitfires in the North African desert, that alone would make a pretty good story. But Bob Hoover's story was just getting started. On his 59th mission, February of 1944, his Spitfire was shot down off the coast of southern France. He survived the crash, the Germans picked him up and sent him to Stalag Luft 1, a prisoner of war camp near Barth, Germany, right on the Baltic coast. Cold, miserable. The kind of place that makes you forget what sunshine feels like. Now here's where it gets interesting. Bob Hoover did not sit quietly in that camp. He tried to escape, not once, not twice. He tried multiple times, and they caught him every time. They threw him in solitary. They roughed him up. Didn't matter. The man was not going to spend the war behind barbed wire if he could help it. And then, in the spring of 1945, with the war winding down and chaos spreading across Germany, Bob Hoover saw his chance. He slipped out of Stalag Luft 1 on foot, through enemy territory, a downed American fighter pilot walking through Germany in the final desperate weeks of the Third Reich. No map worth a darn. No food to speak of, just nerve and the kind of stubborn determination that you either have or you don't. He made his way to a nearby German airfield, and parked on that field was a Focke-Wulf 190. Now, if you know anything about the Focke-Wulf 190, you know it was one of the finest fighters the Luftwaffe ever produced. Radial engine, fast, mean-looking airplane, and Bob Hoover had never sat in one, never read the manual, didn't speak German, so the placards in the cockpit were useless to him. He climbed in anyway. Think about that for a second. You're a starving, beaten-down prisoner of war. You've been locked up for over a year. You find an enemy fighter aircraft on a field in hostile territory, and you decide, yeah, I'm gonna fly that thing out of here. Most people wouldn't even know where to find the fuel selector. Bob Hoover figured out the cockpit, got that big BMW radial turning, and took off. He flew that stolen Focke-Wulf across the lines to the Netherlands and landed at an Allied-held airfield. Now imagine being the ground crew when a German fighter lands on your field and a skinny American in ragged clothes climbs out of the cockpit grinning. I'd have paid good money to see the looks on their faces. But that's the thing about Bob Hoover. That wasn't even the part of his life he was famous for. After the war, Bob became a test pilot. He was Chuck Yeager's backup pilot for the Bell X-1 program. The sound barrier. If Yeager couldn't fly that day, Bob Hoover was the man who would have been first to break the speed of sound. He flew chase plane for the actual flight on October 14, 1947, right there in the high desert over Muroc, which we now call Edwards Air Force Base. He was in the thick of the most dangerous flying being done on Earth, and he was cool as a cucumber. But what made Bob Hoover a legend, what made him the pilot's pilot, was what he did at air shows for the next five decades. He flew a yellow Rockwell Shrike Commander, a twin-engine business airplane, not a fighter, not an aerobatic hot rod. A plain, ordinary piston twin that you might see tied down at any general aviation airport in America. And he did things with that airplane that shouldn't have been possible. He'd come in and do a loop in a Shrike Commander. Then he'd roll it, then, and this is the part that still gives me chills, he would shut down one engine, he'd feather the prop, and he'd do a loop on one engine. Then he'd shut down the other engine, both engines dead, feathered, and he would do a loop, a roll, and a landing from a dead stick energy management profile that was so precise, so perfectly flown, that he'd roll out on the runway, turn off at the taxiway, and coast to a stop right in front of the crowd line. Dead stick, in a twin, after doing aerobatics, and he'd park it exactly where he wanted it. I saw him do this at Oshkosh one year, and I'm telling you, the whole crowd just went silent. Not because it was scary, although it was, but because we were watching something that bordered on art. It was like watching a painter put the last brushstroke on a masterpiece. Every ounce of energy in that airplane was accounted for. Every turn, every pitch change, every second of the routine was calculated with a precision that most of us can barely imagine, let alone execute. People who know a lot more about aerodynamics than I do have said that Bob Hoover's energy management was so refined that he could predict within a few feet where that airplane would stop. Not a few hundred feet, a few feet. In a dead airplane, that's not just skill, that's communion with the machine. And he did all of this with a glass of iced tea on the dashboard. True story, he'd pour himself a glass of tea, set it on the glare shield, and fly the routine. And when he landed, not a drop was spilled. That was his way of showing you just how smooth, how coordinated, how utterly dialed in his flying was. No sloshing, no spilling, just perfection. He also flew a P-51 Mustang in his airshow routine, and that was a whole other kind of beautiful. That big Merlin engine howling across the field, Bob rolling and pulling and doing the kinds of things that made you remember why we all fell in love with airplanes in the first place. He'd come down the line inverted, just a few hundred feet off the deck, and the sound of that Merlin would rattle your chest. Now, the story takes a darker turn in the 1990s. The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, pulled Bob Hoover's medical certificate. They said he was unfit to fly. Bob was in his 70s at the time, and by all accounts he was still sharp as a tack and flying beautifully. The aviation community was outraged. Here was the greatest demonstration pilot in history, a man who had been flying for over 50 years, who had more time and more types than almost anyone alive, and the FAA grounded him. Bob fought it. He fought it hard. It became a cause in the aviation world. Eventually, after a long and bitter battle, his medical was reinstated. He flew again, and when he did, the crowds roared like you wouldn't believe, because Bob Hoover wasn't just a pilot, he was our pilot. He belonged to all of us who ever looked up at an airplane and felt our heart beat a little faster.
He passed away in October of 2016 at the age of 94. And I'll tell you, when I heard the news, I sat in my hangar for a long time and just thought about all the times I'd watched that yellow Shrike Commander float through the sky like the laws of physics were merely suggestions. There are a lot of great pilots in the history of aviation. Lindbergh, Earhart, Yeager, Doolittle, all of them earned their place. But when those pilots, the best of the best, were asked who they thought was the greatest, a lot of them said the same name, Bob Hoover. He never sought the spotlight the way some pilots do. He wasn't flashy in his personality. He was quiet, gracious, and unfailingly kind to every young pilot who came up to shake his hand. I watched him spend 20 minutes talking to a student pilot at Sun N Fun one year, answering every question like it was the most important conversation he'd have that day. That's the measure of the man. The research for tonight's story came largely from Bob's own autobiography, Forever Flying, and from several accounts published by the Experimental Aircraft Association and the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. If you haven't read Forever Flying, do yourself a favor. Swing by radiohanger.com if you want to catch up on past episodes. I'm Tail Dragger. Go fly something this weekend, and when you do, think about old Bob and that glass of iced tea.